Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, film critic and contributing editor for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is Brian Black, formerly of X1075's Extreme Disorder Show.
That's nice. That's a nice way to say that, considering I got fired, Josh.
Well, you know, I'm trying to soft pedal these things.
Well, no,
you know,
make you sound good. I didn't technically get fired, but yes, formerly of Extreme Disorder. Yes.
Right, which was formerly my home as well on the radio, and we had some lovely times.
Yes, as a matter of fact, one of my favorite features. I'm a big movie buff, and you doing the previews on Friday, and then we would do the recap with the listeners doing their reviews on Monday, one of my favorite parts of the show.
It was always a good time. So maybe we can somehow replicate the fun.
Sure.
And
excitement. Can you pay me?
Ooh, that's probably a no on that.
I mean,
front.
I notice you've got some fancy new offices here with flat screen TVs on the walls.
That's true. It is a nice little
don't
studio
really need
here.
Any broken down old radio hosts.
Well, probably not. Okay. No. But I appreciate you coming here nonetheless.
I appreciate you taking me to two free movies this week.
There you go. So let's talk about those movies, starting with Burn After Reading, which is the new movie from the Coen brothers,
yes,
who wrote and directed No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm, which won a bunch of Oscars last year. They're also responsible for Fargo and The Big Lebowski and Miller's Crossing,
yeah,
Blood Simple, a whole bunch of awesome movies.
As it so happens, over the July 4th weekend, I was house-sitting for a friend. And I did a Coen Brothers festival. I watched Hudsucker Proxy. I watched Big Lebowski. I watched a bunch of them in a row. And so I feel like I'm really prepared to comment intelligently on a new Coen Brothers movie.
That, I'm glad that you're prepared. Yeah, that's very admirable of you.
Hey, I got nothing else to do.
So this movie is a Coen comedy, and they tend to alternate between sort of these dark, cynical dramas and these dark, cynical comedies,
yes,
really. And this is not a wacky, you know, Farrelly Brothers type movie, but
right,
it is comedic and full of a lot of Hollywood stars, Brad Pitt and George Clooney, Tilda Swinton, Frances McDormand, and
John Malkovich.
I knew I was missing somebody. And he kind of sets this in motion. It's like the Big Lebowski. It's sort of this convoluted conspiracy story,
right,
where, you know, a lot of ins, a lot of outs,
sure,
and the characters don't really seem to know what's going on. And neither do you, really, towards the end. And it turns out that things have been sort of made more complicated by the characters than they needed to be. John Malkovich plays a CIA agent who gets kind of downsized because he has a drinking problem.
Right.
And as his response to this, he decides he's going to write his explosive memoirs or memoir. He calls them in the movie, and blow the lid off of something, although he's clearly not a very important guy.
Right.
Tilda Swinton, who plays his wife, decides she's going to divorce him. She gets these memoir, the information on some sort of disc, and it gets lost, and it winds up at this gym where Brad Pitt and Frances McDormand work, and they pick it up and they think it's these grand state secrets that they're going to blackmail John Malkovich with. It's very good. And this is like all, you know, this is on even like half the setup, maybe.
Yeah,
it's
and
very
plus throw
complex.
George Clooney into the mix as having sex with John Malkovich's wife, and he's also a U.S. Marshal. It's all takes place in this complicated D.C. sort of mid-level government employee sort of universe.
Right. All these people who seem to think they're way important, way more important than they really are, which is, I think, a hallmark of Coen characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think this movie, after No Country for Old Men, which again, it won a bunch of Oscars, it
sure
was incredibly well reviewed, and probably one of their more financially successful movies, I
absolutely
think. People have high expectations for this. And I think going into this, you might have to modulate your expectations a little.
Right.
I liked this movie, but it's not on the sort of impressive level of some of their other better films. I mean, even something like The Big Lebowski, which is silly,
right,
and light, but is so incredibly well constructed and clever. And I mean,
see,
this is what you don't. You're not a big fan of The Big Lebowski.
No, I mean, I am a fan.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of the Coen brothers, but I've never seen the large cult appeal of The Big Lebowski. I see what's going on when people do like it, but I just don't identify with it. I would put this movie in that same ballpark.
Yeah.
Maybe not as good as The Big Lebowski, because Jeff Bridges was a great performance.
That's an amazing performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I feel like the performances in Burn After Reading, they're all very good, because they're all very good actors, but John Malkovich is acting like John Malkovich.
Right.
And Tilda Swinton is acting like herself. And Frances McDormand is very good as the kind of over-the-hill gym rat.
Right.
And but it just seems like there was this big casting meeting. This is what I thought after the movie. There was this big casting meeting, which, you know, they're all sitting around and they're like, ooh, wouldn't it be crazy if Brad Pitt was this like pseudo-homosexual sort of gym rat guy? And wouldn't it be crazy if we had Frances in there and she was, you know, like, you know, his little partner in crime, and then George can just make up his own part like he always does. And you know what I'm saying? It's like they set up these characters. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they don't. None of them really go anywhere beyond that. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed the movie. But I feel like these characters were all these carefully constructed piles of idiosyncrasies and quirks, and nothing really ever developed for me.
No, that's true. It's definitely something where it seems like they're just like, let's get a bunch of our friends together
right.
and some stars, and we're going to have a good time, and it's this silly story. It doesn't really mean a whole lot. It's sort of inconsequential, but it's a good time. And you know, it conveys that, I think, in the movie. You can see that they're all having a good time,
right.
and that does rub off on you. But it's not something necessarily, I think, that you're going to think about later that much.
Right.
As opposed to a lot of other Coen works. And
yeah.
It's, at least in the setup, in the first maybe 20 or so minutes, I felt like it was a lot of sort of pieces being thrown at you.
Sure.
That it takes a long time for them to all add up. And there's actually the final scene of the movie, which was probably my favorite scene, which doesn't feature any of the main stars. It has J.K. Simmons,
yes.
who's great and is always in Coen Brothers movies.
Right.
And David Rausch, I think is his name. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Who play these sort of, you know, slightly higher level CIA functionaries, but
right.
clearly also not that important, who are sort of trying to parse through what the heck went on in the previous, you know, 90 minutes or whatever. And somehow it brings together the sort of the inconsequential nature of the story, but at the same time, the way that all the characters took it so seriously
right.
and thought. And that, I think there was a nice little irony to it that I appreciated there. But until then, it's very much just like bumping along in a lighthearted way, I think.
I really liked – they were very clever. Like you said, that final scene, which they have a very non-traditional sense of resolution. everybody was – either freaked out or amazed by the ending of No Country for Old Men.
Right.
And this movie actually kind of prides itself on being very clever in tying up all the loose ends, but then showing you that they didn't really need to be tied up.
Right.
But I will say that it is kind of a spy movie, sort of. And there were a couple of things that remained unanswered. And, you know, in another movie like No Country for Old Men, I would have thought that was intentional. But since they're doing so much at the end of this movie to tie everything up, they left a couple of things unanswered. And I felt like maybe they just got a little too clever for their own good.
It's possible. It is. I mean, and I think a little too clever for their own good is a criticism that's launched against the Coens often.
Sure.
By people who are not fans of them. I don't necessarily feel that way. I love the Coen brothers.
Yeah, me too.
And I think their cleverness works very well. And as long as you know what kind of movies they make, they're not going to make, you know, warm-hearted family
yeah.
dramas. They're not going to connect with you emotionally necessarily. But for what they do, they're exceptional at it. But this is maybe a little too clever or a little too much effort.
Yeah. I had read an interview with both of them, and it was in the Playboy interviews. They're publishing all the interviews in book form now,
mm-hmm.
and it was interesting. I think that they've had editorial and Final Cut approval on their movies from the beginning, from Blood Simple
yeah.
on, and they don't get interfered with by the studios, and now with No Country for Old Men being
right.
such a monster success, and still being a really weird, independent kind of movie, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, No Country was not your run-of-the-mill film, and it was not a major studio film, at least. And now I think they can pretty much make – they've always been able to make pretty much what they want to, and now that's been solidified to a point where they don't care. I mean, did you ever see right. Intolerable Cruelty?
I like Intolerable Cruelty.
I never
Intolerable
saw
Cruelty,
it.
Actually.
I never saw it, but I have read so many reviews about how terrible it was.
Yeah, it's definitely considered, I think, by a lot of Coen fans, you know, one of their worst films.
Okay.
That, along with The Lady Killers, which were, ironically, those were the two movies right before No Country. And I think
right.
at that point, a lot of people thought, like, oh, they've kind of lost it. They've, you know, tried to be too mainstream, you know, Lady Killers with starring Tom Hanks and being a remake. Although,
sure.
I don't know if you've seen that. But
I've seen the original. I haven't seen that either, actually.
And it's not very good, but it is certainly, weird and
yeah.
idiosyncratic and not something you would think is like, oh, wow, this is clearly like some sort of studio compromise.
Right.
Not at all.
Well, interestingly enough, even though it's a famous movie, I never liked the original that much, actually. With Alec Guinness and
yeah.
I never thought it was that great. I didn't understand
yeah,
the appeal.
Those Ealing comedies are very, very dry. And I think watching that original Lady Killers, I found it like, a little too dry. It was, I was so removed from it, I couldn't care. And the Coen version is also kind of like that, but then they graph these bizarre character turns. Like Tom Hanks, the accent that he does in that, which he sounds like Colonel Sanders or something, is sort of unbelievably baffling. You don't know what he's trying to do. So anyway, this is a completely
off
unrelated.
Because I was about to go off on Tom Hanks for a second there, because I'm a big Tom Hanks fan, but he doesn't realize he's a movie star, not an actor.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good point, and that Lady Killers was not, and the Coen brothers in general, probably not a good fit for him. But then again, with someone like Clooney, who is also a movie star, he works really well with the Coens,
I think. But you notice what he's been doing a lot lately is those kind of a little bit gritty character roles. I mean, but he is playing the movie star. He doesn't go too far away from, you know, I'm a little bit tough, I'm a little bit gruff, I'm George Clooney, look at me, you know.
But I mean, he's willing to come off as a sort of a buffoon,
in
this
absolutely.
Movie. And in, you know, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and also Intolerable Cruelty, which isn't, you know, another, the last movie he did with the Coens.
Right.
So, back to Burn After Reading. This movie
it
that we were
good.
Talking about. Yeah, it was pretty good, and I think... Again, as a Coen fan, I was hoping for more. And maybe if this had been made by some other filmmaker that I was less familiar with or had less high hopes for, because so much of what they've done has been so good, I would have liked it more. But this does seem like almost like a palate cleanser. Like, look, we made this huge, difficult movie, and now we're just going to jump right into something silly and fun and play with movie stars. And, you know, they've already gone on to their next project, which is completely different, is a 60s period piece that takes place in Minnesota. And the biggest star in it is Richard Kind, who used to be on Spin City. And the supporting cast is local Minnesota actors. So it's a complete departure. But
very smart.
I guarantee you, it'll be completely interesting. So I'm looking forward to that, at least. This movie makes me look forward to their next movie.
Yeah, and I think I liked it a little bit more than you did. When we were walking out of the theater, I really had a good time with it. I had a lot of affection for it. I was mad because the Coens are always so mean to their characters.
They
especially
really are,
ones
yes.
that you like, you know? And, you know, I really liked it, but I even, you know, I got mad at the right places. I laughed at the right places. I rarely laugh out loud in a movie theater. I laughed several times.
Yeah, there were definitely funny bits. Yeah,
it was good, and it was nice and dark, and it was cool. And, you know, I want to see John Malkovich acting like John Malkovich.
Yeah,
I want to see George Clooney. And yes, what you saw in the trailer was funny. Brad Pitt acting like he acts, and it is very, very funny.
Yeah, there's a lot of funny stuff. I think... It didn't quite add up as well as I hoped. But, you know, I gave it 3 stars in my review in the paper. And I think that's, you know, definitely above average. Definitely worth seeing, especially if you like the Coens. But not quite as much as I'd hoped for. So.
See, I would actually rate it a little higher than that,
yeah.
as a matter of fact. I thought it was a really well, you know, they're all well edited. But it was just a good-looking movie. You didn't really see any of the craft. I liked it a little bit more.
Do you want to give it a star rating?
3.5, I'd
three and
say.
A half. All right.
Just a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I really had a good time watching
it. But worth checking out, I think.
And the right length.
That's true. It was only like 95 minutes. It definitely...
Perfect.
And that final scene, too. It starts and you're like, oh, there's more happening. And then you realize... Oh, this is the end.
Yeah.
And it's exactly the right time for it to be
exactly.
the end. I think that works. So, and now moving on to a movie that I don't think either of us particularly liked, but in a way is disappointing too, which is Righteous Kill, starring the great, or at least formerly great, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino as a pair of veteran police officers, partners on the force, who are tracking down a serial killer who is killing... bad people, rapists and drug dealers and so on and so forth. And all of these people have a connection to the Pacino and De Niro characters. And so I don't think it's really a spoiler to say that De Niro's character sort of comes under suspicion pretty much right at the outset of this movie.
Absolutely. The first scene.
Right. And you're meant to think that he is, in fact, this serial killer. And as you go through, it's sort of some flash forwards to what is meant to be his confession, I guess. And we go through seeing the investigation as they track this guy and Donnie Wahlberg and John Leguizamo, two acting heavyweights.
Actors.
Right, exactly. They're really the De Niro and Pacino of today.
No, they are not.
they play the fellow cops who are suspecting De Niro of something. And Carla Gugino, who I love, Carla Gugino. She's a good-looking woman. She's a great actress and is stuck in this awful part in this movie where she plays this sort of CSI technician who has this weird violence fetish, and she wants Robert De Niro to, like, beat her up. And the whole Robert De Niro, Carla Gugino rough sex scenes, not something we needed to see in this movie.
Yeah, because they're actually shooting the entire movie. I'll tell you, they're shooting Robert De Niro with the MySpace angles.
Yeah.
That kind of lose the gut.
Exactly.
And there was a couple of scenes where I was like, wow, he actually looks like he's in shape. No, the camera's just right above his shoulder.
Right.
And it kind of obscures the rest of his body.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. I mean, I think one of the ridiculous things about this movie is the way that they're sort of in denial about how old De Niro and Pacino are.
Right.
Which is, I mean, it's not shameful. People get old. Everyone gets old. It happens.
Well, and they, Clint Eastwood is the best example of somebody who can play a 60-something-year-old character that is still a badass, but feels his age as well.
Right, absolutely.
So, and I really think that was a mistake from the beginning in this movie, is that they weren't playing even close to their age.
No.
You know, it wasn't a really physical role. They weren't, you know, jumping around and rolling around and shooting stuff or anything like that. But on the other hand, there was, I don't know, there was some silly scene where Pacino is, like, on his motorcycle and these two hot girls are talking to him, and I'm like, that would not happen if he wasn't Al Pacino.
Right, right.
It just wouldn't happen.
And he doesn't even, you know, they both look, Pacino especially, I think, looks really haggard.
Sure.
And he has these awful hair pieces that he's wearing in these
recent
movies.
Are those hair pieces?
They have to be hair pieces. I mean, either that or someone has really messed with his hair in a really bad way.
I gotta say, it's one of his best features there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably why he's, you know, holding on to it.
Sure.
But, you know, very, very poofy hair, I
sure,
think Pacino has endured.
Don't you talk about Pacino's
hair. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that was such a sensitive subject. But yeah, the other thing is about them, like, on the one hand, you're like, oh, they're really trying to, you know, they're trying to burnish their image. They're trying to be tough guys.
Sure.
But on the other hand, they're clearly not trying very hard at all throughout this movie. They both seem like they're sleepwalking.
Yes.
Like, they're like, well, whatever, we'll do this movie because some, you know, my manager passed me this script.
And the buzz for ever since Godfather 2 is that they, you know, hadn't been in a movie together in the same scene until Heat.
Right.
And then that was only for 2 minutes.
Right.
And
now in together, every freaking scene together.
And it's
lame. It's totally
well,
lame.
Like you said, sleepwalking. I would say De Niro was doing De Niro light. He couldn't decide if he wanted to be the broken down has been or he wanted to be the badass. He was flopping back and forth and not very hard either way.
No.
Pacino was not being crazy Pacino, and he wasn't being good actor. What did he play? King Lear or something like that? He wasn't being good actor Pacino either.
Yeah.
He was just kind of waffling in the middle because they're trying to keep us in the dark so much with the plot that the director foolishly, apparently, told them to not really develop their characters.
They really do underplay everything so that you're surprised at the end. But, of course, it's not a very surprising twist. And there's no suspense built to the point where you would even care what the twist is.
I wouldn't say no. I would
very
say the
little.
Saving grace of this movie was that I guessed immediately what the secret was. Like, not even 2 seconds into it. However, I was fascinated by the way that it unfolded in a certain way, to the point where I kind of developed a little bit of affection for it. You know, it was like, you know, one of those movies that it's kind of a comfort movie where you're hanging out with old friends and you're just glad to see them on the screen. And I liked that, but that's the only thing in the movie that I liked whatsoever. 50 Cent is a bad actor.
Oh, he is a terrible actor. And luckily he's barely in this movie. But if you ever see Get Rich or Die Tryin', and I would not recommend that.
Oh,
but
God.
The movie in which 50 Cent plays himself
very
poorly. he's terrible.
He mumbles.
He really does. He's really awful. And I mean, I don't know that I was necessarily comforted to see them because it's almost sad to see them now because they're so great or were so great. And you feel like could be great again if they had the right project, if they took more care in choosing what they did, if they put more effort into what they were doing, then maybe something would click again. You know, Clint Eastwood can still give a great performance.
Absolutely.
Why couldn't they, you know?
I couldn't tell you. You would think this would be the perfect formula for them to shine, you know? But I honestly lay it all at the feet of the director, John Avnet.
Yeah.
And is that how you pronounce it?
Why not?
I lay it completely at his feet. I feel like the direction was very poor. There were the screenplay was not nearly as clever as it thought it was.
Right.
But there were good lines in there, but they were directed so badly that they were like, you know, Pacino's supposed to be the smartass, and he's got these clever little jokes or whatever several times throughout the movie, and I heard laughter in the theater or whatever.
Yeah.
But the timing was off, the way that the scenes were shot was off. It was, I'd say, badly directed and edited.
Right. No, I would agree. And there's all those scenes where they deal with the psychiatrist where it's just like these extreme close-ups of faces and quick flashes, and it's very disorienting and not in a good way. So
the same guy edited this movie as edited Mission Impossible, which is a movie most people didn't like and I did like.
I kind of like that too. But
it has that same kind of swooshy. Every time the scene changes, you hear,
right.
You know, and I don't know. It got irritating after a while, and like you say, it got a little bit sad. I did have some affection for it, but Donnie Wahlberg is not a good actor, and I hate John Leguizamo.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a big fan of Leguizamo, but I feel like he was toned down enough here that I could tolerate him, and I don't mind Donnie Wahlberg. I think he's done some decent work. I would certainly not
He was good in the Diamond Men movie. Was that him?
Maybe. I didn't see that movie.
With the dude from, I can't remember his name. Yeah, Robert. The guy from Jackie Brown. Robert...
De Niro? He was in Jackie Brown.
No.
Robert Forster.
Forrester.
Yeah.
That was a good movie.
Yeah.
Unlike this movie.
Yes. Many, many movies unlike this movie better. So I'm going to say 2 stars for this.
I'm going down to 1.5.
Ooh.
I did not like this movie, even though I really wanted to. And I will say it's a guy movie to the point where everybody I mentioned, I said I was going to see 2 movies this week, and all the guys were really excited about the fact that De Niro and Pacino were in a movie together.
Right.
I'm sorry, it's just not that great. Run Heat.
Oh, yeah,
honestly.
And Heat is a phenomenal movie. That's one of my favorite movies ever.
Best gun battle ever filmed.
It's awesome, awesome. Heat is amazing. So let's move on. This, interestingly enough, from this super guys guy movie, we can move on to a movie that I know you haven't seen, but that I have seen. Not yet. Well, I wouldn't recommend seeing it. Not at any time in the future. But a very much chick flick, I guess you would call it, which is The Women, a remake of a really good movie that I would recommend seeing from 1939, also called The Women, directed by George Cukor, with Joan Crawford and Rosalind Russell and Norma Shearer, which is just a really, really clever, catty, slightly campy, but really well-made sort of comedic melodrama about New York City socialites and one main character whose husband is cheating on her and sort of how she deals with that with the support of her friends and also the antagonism of the guy's mistress and some of the ways that women deal with each other,
right.
And which is the same exact plot as this new version, which stars Meg Ryan in the main role as the woman who has been wronged, and Annette Bening as her best friend, and Eva Mendes as the mistress.
Mm.
And
I'm cool with that.
Jada Pinkett Smith and Deborah Messing play their sort of secondary. Yeah,
they're not
all right.
No.
No, and this is a movie that, first of all, the cast is terrible. I will
say
this.
See, Meg Ryan has just fallen into the sewer.
She really has.
What is going on with her?
And she looks awful. Like, the amount of plastic surgery that she has inflicted upon herself is disturbing. She looks like the Jack Nicholson Joker with her sort of perma smile. And it's very unsettling. And even more so.
She used to be so cute.
She really did. And Annette Bening, who can be a solid actress, also doesn't look. She looks very, you know, her skin is sort of Joan Rivers-ish, pulled tightly. And neither of them, they give these very, like, sort of shrill, in-your-face performances. Like, they're trying to play up the cattiness, but it just comes off as really desperate. And Deborah Messing, I cannot stand, no matter what she does. And Jada Pinkett sort of wanders through.
She's not a very good actress.
No, she's a very low-key actress, and here she plays the token lesbian, but, you know, they don't do anything with that. None of the updating of this movie is done in a clever way at all. It seems like it's just sort of playing off some second-rate Sex in the City type stuff. And it's just a mess.
Wow, and, if you're second rate to Sex in the City.
Right, and the Sex in the City movie, at least, I did not care for. I can't say much about the show. But it doesn't know what it's going to do, I think. And it tries to be sort of empowering to women, but at the same time, it follows the plot of the original, which is a great movie, but is very much of its time,
right.
And ultimately has these sort of old-fashioned values to it that it's hard to put forth in a movie that's claiming to be about strong women in 2008.
Right.
And it's just so many muddled bits. It just does not add up. And it's unfortunate because, like I said, I love the original. And I feel like maybe with a different cast, this could have been better. It's a first-time director, Diane English, who created Murphy Brown, which is a landmark in terms of power,
sure.
You know, strong women characters in media. But this isn't maybe her forte or whatever. So disappointing. I think you know, both on the guy's guy front and the girl's girl front this week, not so good. So I would give the women 2 stars as well, about as good as Righteous Kill.
Do you think that it'll make money, though? Do you think this is the kind of movie that it might actually appeal to,
I think it'll
appeal a huge crowd of morons?
The League of Morons, as they say in Burn After Reading.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, I think this is a movie that was actually delayed for a really long time and probably would have ended up going straight to video if it were not for the fact that Sex and the City made a bunch of money.
Right.
And suddenly Warner Brothers decided, wait a minute, we can throw this into theaters and somebody will go see it.
Especially if it didn't cost a lot to make.
And I don't know. You think with all those actresses, it might have cost a good amount. But the point is, the studio had kind of written it off, and now they figure whatever they're going to get from it, I think, is worthwhile.
Right.
But I don't think it'll be a huge hit. I think even people who love Sex and the City, the thing about Sex and the City, it's not just the subject matter. It was the goodwill built up over years of that series that was very popular. And this doesn't have that. And it's only superficially similar. It's much more old-fashioned, much more about marriage and things like that. So I wouldn't predict a big box office. I think, you know, Righteous Kill will be the one that makes the money this week.
You think?
And I do, because like you said, everyone you talk to was interested
in
seeing it.
We'll have a big weekend, maybe.
Yeah, it's not going to have a long life. And this is a terrible time for movies right now anyway, in terms of the time of year. You know, Burn After Reading is surprising that a movie like that with that kind of pedigree would be coming out at this time of year, because usually this is dumping ground for stuff that studios don't want to bother with.
Well, maybe the studios know something we don't know.
Well, I think we do, unfortunately, know it now, which is that these movies aren't any good, and we've experienced it. So moving on to stuff that's coming up on DVD on Tuesday, one movie that was a big failure,
huge failure
over the summer, a colossal failure, really, was the Wachowski brothers' version of Speed Racer.
I saw that.
And I saw it as well, and this is not a good movie, I don't think, but at the same time, I sort of respected its ridiculousness.
See, I actually expected it to be the worst movie I'd ever seen because it's got an annoying kid in it, and I hate an annoying kid. Most child actors suck, and this one is no doubt. I don't even know who he is.
True,
he sucks.
True. And the chimp.
And it has the chimp, and, you know, and it's kind of a, you know, like, the whole point of enjoying Speed Racer is kind of like being a Star Trek original series fan, is that you may love it, but you also kind of have to pick on it too,
right,
you know?
Sure.
And this, they don't do that with this movie. It's taking itself very seriously, and it looks, I think people expected me to say it looks amazing. I wouldn't say it looks amazing. It looks like it cost a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of...
It's cool.
Some of what they do, not necessarily just the effects, like, wow, that's a great thing that they did with the computer, but some of just the visual style.
Sure, sure.
The way the films are, the scenes are shot with those transitions where it's constantly sort of, like, the entire scene, it just never stops panning.
You're
And things morph into each other. Like, it seemed like they went back. I mean, the Wachowskis are super serious. And, like, you know, for something like this where you don't really need to, it seems like they decided, we're going to invent an entirely new visual language to make this movie with, which was wholly unnecessary and not warranted by this stupid subject matter.
Not that incredibly interesting either. It's just like, you know, I mean, it's, I don't know, it's like basically a lot of work for no real result. It could have been done in, I don't know, once again, really cool stuff, and I expected it to be absolutely terrible and was pleasantly surprised that it was actually pretty cool.
It is, I think, better than its reputation suggests.
Yeah.
And if you're a geek for sort of filmmaking technical stuff, then I think you'll find a lot to appreciate about it, but you probably won't connect with it in any sort of, you know, emotional way or humor way.
Yeah, none of the characters have any depth whatsoever.
No. And it's, I love the original Matrix, and I love Bound, the Wachowski's first movie.
Same with me.
And I, you know, at the time that those movies came out, I thought, these guys are geniuses. They're going to have some amazing career, and they just have not at all. And I really would love to see them make a great movie again.
I see them, like, in the same league as James Cameron, who used to be really cool but got so bogged down in the technique that he's forgotten that he should be making movies that are entertaining and interesting and look good and, you know, have a lot of craft to them, but also have good acting and good direction. The same could really apply to George Lucas.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wouldn't yet tar them with the George Lucas brush. That's,
they haven't
that's
fallen
harsh
so far.
Yes.
I don't know. I really think that Matrix 2 and 3 was one good movie surrounded by about 2 hours of crap.
Yeah. Well, I agree. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put a lot of defense into those two movies. That's what I'm saying. But, you know, go back to the original Matrix or you go back to Bound.
Excellent.
Those are both great movies and seem like they had this sort of boundless imagination.
Sure.
And
both very concise movies, which is the problem with all the movies subsequent, is that they didn't know when to quit any level.
Yeah, a movie about the Speed Racer should not be like 2 hours and 15 minutes long.
Should have been a 90-minute movie.
Yes. So an unfortunate disappointment. And one more thing I think coming up on DVD that we should mention in light of Righteous Kill is another movie starring Al Pacino, directed by John Avnet. Also terrible.
Wow, what a combo. I wanted to rent this.
Which is 88 minutes. And I would say worse than Righteous Kill.
Wow.
Definitely worse than Righteous Kill. Even more insanely ridiculous, stupid-ass plot.
Do we at least get crazy Pacino in this movie?
He's a little crazier. Okay. And the hair is bigger.
Okay.
I would say my attention during this movie was drawn almost solely to the hair.
Okay.
And its ridiculous poofiness.
Sure.
Where he plays this, he's like a professor of criminology, or he's a psychiatrist. I totally forgot the plot already. I saw
it's
it like 3 months
ago.
Like
a serial killer profiler.
Yeah, there you
like
go.
That.
But he's
yeah.
also a professor. And then
right.
Somebody's targeting him, and there's a serial killer that he put away who's in prison, and he thinks he's responsible. And I can't even remember who the culprit was.
It was really important.
I'll tell you. I shouldn't, in case anyone cares.
Now, this was a real-time movie.
No, see, this is the annoying thing about this movie.
This movie
titled 88 Minutes is like 110 minutes long.
Oh, I could have sworn that
no.
Or there's not a section of the movie that's in real time or something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah, they fudge it. I mean, there's a point where he gets a phone call. There's like 20 minutes of the movie first. And
right.
then he gets this phone call where the guy says, you only have 88 minutes to live. And then periodically, they're checking in on that. Oh, you
right.
only have 50
but
minutes.
It's not real
but
time
it doesn't seem to line up, or at least it didn't seem that way to me.
Okay.
And I felt like at least if it had some stupid gimmick like that,
see, I like
could have
that.
Tied it together.
I had a lot of affection for Nick of Time.
Yeah.
And what was another one? Oh, High Noon, of course.
Right, right.
But,
yeah, something like that really builds the tension.
Sure,
but
sure.
Here, no, it doesn't work, and very bad.
Good hair, though.
Good, well, entertaining hair,
okay.
I will say.
Entertaining
not necessarily
hair.
Good hair. But if you want to see Pacino, well, rent something old, but even Righteous
yeah.
Kill is better
Devil's
than
Advocate.
This. Devil's Advocate. There's
if
good,
you want crazy,
good crazy Pacino.
Pacino yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Where the sort of over-the-topness is called for because he plays, you know, Satan. And if you can't be over-the-top
Satan in that movie?
Then,
that must be like in the second half.
I didn't mean to spoil no. anything for you there.
Damn.
So, and then quickly, I want to – something that you actually might want to rent or buy on DVD, a couple TV shows that I'm a big fan of, and since the new TV season is starting, both of the first seasons of these two shows are coming out on DVD, one of which is Chuck, which is on NBC, which is a sort of fun spy show about the sort of hapless nerd who inadvertently gets a bunch of spy info shoved into his brain and has to get – you know, drawn into these silly conspiracy, you know, adventures and whatnot. And it's very lighthearted and goofy, but very entertaining, good acting, better than you would expect it to be. And I think
okay.
it's a kind of an entertaining little show that I hope the ratings, I think, were a little up and down. It's coming back. I'm not sure.
It had a lot of hype to it. I remember that.
It did. And, you know, it's not brilliant necessarily, but it's a lot of fun. It's something that I tune into every week, and I always was always happy to watch. There was always a laugh. It was sort of, you know, almost like Get Smart or something like that. It's not realistic in any way, but it's entertaining. The characters were fun. And then there's also Pushing Daisies, which is a show on ABC that's also about to come back for its second season. Very quirky, and a show that also had a lot of buzz, and that I sort of at first felt like was a little too quirky
yeah.
about this guy who can resurrect dead people by touching them, but only for 1 minute. And he uses this to sort of help solve mysteries. And he also owns a diner where they serve pie. And he has his former love of his life, who he resurrected and kept her alive, but he can't touch her because if he touches her again, then she'll be dead. Very complicated. It is an interesting twist.
That's an interesting
and
twist.
It kind of takes a lot to get it all set up and set in motion. It's one of those things where if you have to explain it, it sounds very confusing. But once they set it
sure.
up while you're watching, it all seems to sort of fit together organically. And it has this very sort of – the first couple episodes were directed by Barry Sonnenfeld.
Oh, okay.
And it has a very sort of – Adam's Family-ish or more, you know, Tim Burton-ish kind of whimsy to it.
And lots of style.
Lots of style. And at times maybe almost too much style.
Gotcha.
And if that whimsy kind of doesn't do it for you, then you might find it an overload. But I thought it actually had a lot of, again, like emotional power to it. The whole thing with the relationship between him and the girl that he can't touch is very touching. I mean, not literally touching, obviously.
Right, right.
So both of those, Chuck and Pushing Daisies, coming out on DVD this coming Tuesday, I think those are worth taking a look and maybe checking out when the new seasons premiere.
And that is absolutely the way to get into a TV show, is to watch the entire first season.
Right.
And then you'll get sucked in.
You'll be primed
yeah.
for the next one. And both of them are short because of the writer's strike. Both were cut short. I think Chuck was only 13 episodes
okay.
and Pushing Daisies probably the same. So you can get through them fairly quickly.
Cool.
So I think that's going to do it. The bottom line, go see Burn After Reading this week, I think.
You should.
That's the main summary. Brian Black, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me here.
All right. And for Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell.
Josh Bell hates everything
except me.